Okay. This is an oral history interview in a series that's being conducted by the University Archives and Special Collections Unit, Paul V. Galvin Library, Illinois Institute of Technology. This is Thursday, October 25th, 2018, and we're located in the Donnelly Room of Galvin Library. I am Ralph Pugh, IIT's University Archivist, and I conduct these interviews alongside Adam Strome, IIT's Director of University Archives and Special Collections. Today we're speaking with Judith Mader, wife and professional associate of Bob Mader. Bob attended IIT's Institute of Design in the early 1970s to study photography on a graduate level, hence his connection with IIT. He met Judith in 1960 and married her in 1965, so she was with him pretty much every step of the way from young adulthood onwards, professionally and personally. Unfortunately, Bob died in 2005, so she carries his narrative as well as her own. So thank you for coming.
Oh, thank you very, very much. It's a pleasure to be here. Yeah. So I think one thing that would be very helpful for people who might be interested in Bob at some future point is to know how he developed as an artist from his early childhood. When he was a young boy, he lived in a family that was, I guess, what we call today unsophisticated as it related to the arts. His father was a salesman, his mother was a homemaker, and little did the arts penetrate the home, and not only in their selection of the living that surrounded them, i.e. architecture, et cetera, et cetera. However, they did live in Oak Park, and in Oak Park were several of the homes that Frank Lloyd Wright designed, and Bob recalled many times, you know, going and seeing those, and that was a very powerful influence in him. And then he did have an aunt who had a membership to the Art Institute of Chicago and would take Bob frequently to the Art Institute from the time he was quite young. And that was another powerful influence on him. Another thing that enabled him to dream, as we say, which we now know is very important in the creative mind, was that his parents did have the means to have a cottage up in Michigan. And during the summers, he would go up there and he would have lots and lots of time by himself. Mm-hmm. And he always talked about those summers and the time to fish and just be in nature and, you know, and that sort of thing that enabled his mind to grow in ways that perhaps someone who's in a different situation might not be able to. Through strange circumstances, he ended up going to a small college, Wheaton College, which, if you know the whole narrative of his life, sounds like a strange choice for him. But he was influenced by some very strong male mentors who convinced him not to go to Dartmouth, where he had a football scholarship, but go to Wheaton College, where he could be a part of their organization, Young Life. And so he listened to them, and he went there. I'm glad he did, because that's where I met him. But also there, he had the opportunity to go and do his first photographic assignment in the Middle East in 1962 when he was 19 years old. He went with the University of Chicago. They were going to do a archaeological dig in Dothan, Jordan, I believe it's Jordan. And he went and he documented that whole trip in great detail with Kodachrome color slides. Mm-hmm. Which will be a part of the archives. And one of the things most notable about them, and which also tells you a lot about the artist, is every slide in his own handwriting has a transcription of what that slide contained, where it was taken, and that sort of thing. So that kind of detail was a really powerful part of how Bob operated. And then when he graduated, we ended up going to Mexico and Guatemala for a year, where he was working for a small publication, Mexico This Month, and he was the photographer, And we traveled all around that area, and that was another really strong influence on his life. His sensibility to people of the Third World, which had begun really in the Middle East, seeing what was going on over there in 1962 was very disturbing, as it is to this day. And then in Mexico and Guatemala, we also did not live as tourists. We lived as people did, as the regular people did, you know, ate off the streets and that sort of thing. So he was developing that sensibility, which I think all these things feed an artist. Then when we came back to Chicago, he decided that he really wanted to get into film. And he went to the Art Institute of Chicago in film. And he had some great classes with Ken Josephins, and he was in a community of really exciting artists at that time. And I just lost my train of thought, but it's going to come back to me. But film, doing film, as in movie film, is very expensive. And we didn't have the resources for him to do that. And so he started becoming frustrated with that. And looked around. He was trying writing. He was a good writer. And then he was like, you know, I think I want to go into photography. And he found out about the Institute of Design. And he explored that. First, they told him no, he was too old, which is interesting because I think he was
27, 28. Yeah.
And they said no. Arthur Siegel, specifically, those of people who know Arthur Siegel know that would not be unlike him, said no, you're too old, decidedly, for this program. But somehow he managed to become friends with a couple other faculty, and they convinced Siegel to let him in the program. And so he always said his entire life that the most powerful influence on him photographically was his experience being able to study with some of the great people that were at the Institute of Design.
Yeah.
Aaron Siskin, you know, just the influence of the greats like Harry Callahan, although he wasn't actually there then. Just being immersed in the history of photography, understanding the importance of knowing the history of art, the history of photography, what it means to discuss form and design, mm-hmm. you know, and how powerful those elements are if you want to really develop as an artist.
Yeah. I want to kind of go back a little bit. Since you were with him from the early 60s onward and you met at Wheaton, reading what we've got in print about his going to Wheaton and something of more of a religious aspect or religious vision that he had, obviously potentially a different sort of career path, pretty conservative place.
Very conservative.
Especially in 1960.
Right.
And you're there as well. But there's a real sort of migration from that. But the interesting thing for scholars, I guess, is where's the intellectual migration? What was the experience? How did his kind of mission in the world change? Was it the 60s? Or was it just that he was such a bright guy who was interested in 12 things simultaneously, and it just, how did that change happen?
Yeah.
Because you talk about, you know, going to the Third World and recognizing the challenges, but, you know, he came from something more of a more privileged background. And how did that happen? How was that experience?
That's an excellent question. When he was in high school, his father, I'll just be straight honest, he was a severe alcoholic, and Bob started becoming quite disillusioned with life and was contemplating lots of alternative things to, you know, going to college, etc. And Young Life, this organization, saw the potential in him, and there were some really strong figures in there, as I said, and they talked him into going to Wheaton. Now, how I got to Wheaton was kind of the reverse. My parents were extremely conservative and fought me going to Wheaton because they thought it was too liberal.
Wow.
So we're coming from opposite ends of the spectrum.
From a Pentecostal background,
right,
or something like that?
Extreme. Well, mm-hmm. My parents lost two children and they had turned to religion in kind of an unhealthy way. But anyway,
yeah.
So when we met, and Bob, we had some incredible professors at Wheaton. One was Clyde Kilby, who was good friends with C.S. Lewis and Tolkien, had known them intimately, and Saul and Bob, you know, this gifted young man. But also, I forgot a very important thing. When he went to Oak Park High School, he met a man who taught English and was a high school football coach and had had Hemingway in his class. Mm-hmm. And Bob always said he taught him, he was the first man that taught him that you could be a macho, you know, football player or whatever, mm-hmm. and you could also be a scholar, mm-hmm. you know, that mm-hmm. you could have both. You mm-hmm. it wasn't mutual, because he grew up in an era in the 50s, his father was, you know, straight, macho. So that was a big influence. Mm-hmm. So he's got that, and he's got mm-hmm. Kilby. And then our friends, well, I'm getting ahead of myself. So then as we went along in school, Bob started really getting deeply into the study of philosophy and mm-hmm. Kierkegaard and all kinds of people. And he's like, he couldn't reconcile what was going on at Wheaton with, you know, then he goes to the Middle East and sees what's going on there. And it's like, you know, and the 60s are happening. I mean, Bob and I were here in the 60s in Chicago.
Right.
I mean, we were on the streets. We saw friends get beaten up by the Chicago police. Mm-hmm. You know, our friends were being drafted to Vietnam and killed. And, you know, so, yeah, it's... life has a strange way of changing that. So he almost dropped out of Wheaton, actually, in our senior year, but somehow he stayed and finished there. And does that answer your question?
Yeah, it does. Yeah, right.
Yeah, okay.
A lot of great people, great program.
Yeah, there were some great intellectuals there conservative nature.
Yeah.
The overall atmosphere was extremely, you know, narrow, and mm-hmm. but there were individuals, mm-hmm. you know, who, even though they were there, you know, had broader perspectives.
Okay, yeah, that definitely answers that question. Yeah. And then, like, say the 60s was...
And then the 60s, I mean, we were here. Mm-hmm. We were here. That was a very, very...
And yeah, so in the mid-60s, you're traveling Mexico City in 67, Guatemala in 66, but you're back in time for 68. What a good time to come back.
Yeah.
So were you...
There's a great mm-hmm. piece done by one of our friends in the book that talks about... I mean, he's a great writer, and he talks about going into the mouth of the lion as we went into the Democratic Convention, seeing people just smashed and, you know.
So you were out on the street in the convention. Yeah.
That's why when Obama stood in the, I mean, I still get chills because I was there and, you know, the chills. I was there when they were smashing heads, and then you're standing there and Obama's president.
Wow, that's going to be cool. I got some questions. I teach Chicago history here
on a major
basis, and I always make sure the students watch an entire session of documentation on the world, 1968 Chicago Convention, because that's so crucial. But what, did you come back in the spring? Were you here for this?
Okay, so let me see if I can get this straight, mm-hmm. the history. So we graduated. I went to... teaching school out east, and he worked. This is interesting. He was still sort of affiliated with some Christian. I don't know if they were Christian or they were part of the anti-poverty movement in New York. Anyway, he went to New York City and worked for an organization that was trying to, I think it was still Young Life, was trying to get the kids out of the city into the country. And he worked up in Harlem, and his bodyguard was Kareem Abdul-Jabbar in Harlem. He became friends with him. And then I worked on the Lower East Side somewhat in the anti-poverty program. Anyway, we were in New York from 64 to 65. And then we got married, and that's, let's see, then what do we do?
Why'd you get married with the Methodists? Coming from that conservative background of yours, were they, was that a conservative
or
no, progressive?
Oh no, my
kind?
Father and my brother are buried there.
Oh, okay.
It's just, it's like,
it's, just,
it's like
a family,
it's like this size house.
It's
know.
A family thing.
Yeah,
okay.
It's, yeah.
Okay, go ahead. Yeah,
yeah.
In terms of New York.
And, so, mm-hmm. And then now I'm getting confused. I think, okay, 65, did we come back to Chicago? Yeah, Bob was drawn back to Chicago. He wanted, and I taught school, and we lived on Bower.
Where's Bower?
Bowler. Bowler. Ballers.
Where is that?
It's on the west side.
Oh, okay.
Did I say Bowler? Bowler.
That's what it looks like, Bowler. B-O-W-L-E-R.
Bowler, yeah.
In this book.
Yeah, we lived in this little basement with all the way we could heat anything was a little tiny, like, burner or something. I'm sure it would have burned the house down, but I don't know. Anyway, mm-hmm. He taught, he was trying to find himself. He was in a really, you know, what's the word? He was in a... he was fighting with himself about who he was, you know. He was always much more in tune with that than I was. I was, you know, I came from, you have to function, you know, you get a job, and I that's always who I've been. So I taught school, then he got a job teaching second grade or something, and he was driving a cab. Mm-hmm. He drove a cab at night, he loved driving, and he would write his writing, you know, he was trying to find himself. And then I think the next year is, oh, we went to, you won't believe what we did. So.
This is 66, 67.
Yeah, so we went to, Union Theological Seminary, believe it or not. Because Bob was thinking, maybe I need to get back into this religious thing. Maybe there's something there. Mm-hmm. So we went to New York for the summer. And then I got a settlement from a car accident. And we had some money. Mm-hmm. And we bought a ticket and went to visit our friends who were translating ancient Mayan dialect in the hills of Guatemala. Mm-hmm. And we flew down there and lived with them. And that was when Guatemala was armed guards everywhere. I mean, it was military takeover. It was very dramatic.
So there's a coup going on there.
There's a coup going on. And I lost a child down there. And it was. And then we went to Mexico. And that was, we lived on $2 a day. We hitchhiked around. And I got a job in teaching, you know, for little money. I mean, mm-hmm. Do you want to know all this? I don't know. Is
oh,
this
no.
important?
Yeah, yeah.
Is it? Okay.
Uh-huh.
Well,
yeah,
Bob
yeah.
was shooting all the time mm-hmm. now. Mm-hmm. He's shooting. Mm-hmm. He's got his little Leica, I think he had. Would that make sense? A Leica?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And and he worked for this little publication, Mexico This Month. And our son,
uh-huh.
Barron, has done a film on this town that we spent time in, Tlacultepec,
uh-huh.
which is a... Do you know anything about this? Have I told you about this? Am I digressing too far?
No,
no.
Really?
You're
on, okay.
You're on,
so we're in Mexico City. Mm-hmm. I'm teaching at this little place. I'm teaching English, right?
Mm-hmm.
Bob's working for this publication, mm-hmm. shooting. And he comes home and he said, I just met the most incredible guy and I'm going to go with him to this remote town. And of course, there's no communication. You know, there's no...
Mm-hmm.
communication at all. There's no roads back there. He said, I won't be gone too long.
Hmm.
And he was gone about 3 weeks.
Wow.
And I was by myself in Mexico City. I'm like, okay.
He's just been kidnapped or something.
Yeah.
Like that.
I mean, I have no idea. He comes back and he said, you have to come with me.
Hmm.
You will never have another experience like this.
Hmm.
So I said, okay.
Uh-huh.
So we took a bus, third class bus, down to this little stop, I can't remember the name of it, and we got off the bus,
mm-hmm.
and we started hitchhiking. I mean, walking. You had to walk to this town,
mm-hmm.
and it was about a 12-hour walk through the mountains.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
And, no, wait a minute, was it, no, we got a hitch, we hitchhiked on this, on a truck that took us about halfway. And then the truck dropped us off. He said, there's no more road. You know, I can't go any further.
Mm-hmm.
You have to hike back in. The name of the town was Tlacultepec. And it's in the book
mm-hmm.
as a section of the book.
Mm-hmm.
And And we hitchhiked back in there, and I remember thinking, I'll never be able to make it. But we made it, and it was like going back in town. There were no wheels. The women were literally, you know, spending all day crushing the corn and washing their clothes, and we lived back there for a while. And then Bob decided with this guy, Alan Witt, that they were going to explore the caves. Mm. There were Mayan caves. You know, the Mayans had a lot of caves. Did you guys know that?
No.
There's thousands of miles of caves that the Mayans knew intimately and used for sacrifice and for you know, being able to go places, and they're just totally unexplored. So Bob and this guy decided to go into these caves and explore. Now the townspeople told them not to do that, that they would get very sick, and they thought it was, you know, just a tale, you know. And they went in, and they spent a couple days in there, and came back out, and damned if Bob didn't get sick. I mean, really sick.
Like bacterial now, stuff?
Yeah,
or
like high raging fever. Mm-hmm. He's delirious. And I'm back in this town. I'm like, what am I going to do?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No phones. I can't walk out and leave him. Mm-hmm. So I got the townspeople to tell me what to give him. I gave him whatever they told me. And he just started feeling better. And I'm walking into down this cobblestone street to the little tiny store, which is like as big as this, you know. And I'm walking down the street, and I look up, and here coming toward me is this couple with this woman in high heels covered with diamonds and... And by the way, when you travel in Mexico at that time, mm-hmm. you didn't wear anything that revealed that you had any resources at all. Mm-hmm. Because mm-hmm. when you're dealing with desperate poverty,
right.
you know,
right.
you're a gringo anyway, so
yeah,
you
right.
know you've got to have money. How'd you get there?
Yeah.
But if you show, so, you know, the whole thing was to show no assets at all. Mm-hmm. So this woman is walking down in these spiked high heels. She had a gold something on, and she's blonde, and this guy is, you know, in this $2,000 suit or whatever, and she's got heels on, trying to walk on these, and they're walking toward me. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, and then I look, and I recognize the guy. His name was Morgan Maxfield. He had gone to Wheaton with us.
Oh,
And he's walking toward me. And I mean, it was like you feel like you're delirious, right? And he looks at, I don't know if he recognized me or not. I probably didn't look very good. But anyway, turns out that he's a very wealthy guy, right? Multimillionaire. And he wanted to have an adventure. So he went into Mexico City and hired a private plane. And there was a small area outside the town, you know, a couple miles or I don't know how far out of the town, that was flat enough that you could land a small plane. So he had this pilot, you know, he said, I want to go to the most remote place. And this pilot takes them to Tlacoltepec.
Wow.
I mean, who could have made that story up? And then I tell them, you know, that Bob's been desperately sick and, you know, he's finally getting better. So I bring them back to our little tiny room that we rented from this lady. In fact, in the film, my son goes back to that woman's house.
Ah.
But anyway, and Bob, of course, he thinks he's hallucinating, you know. And, of course, they immediately say, well, let's go. Let's get you out of here.
Right.
And we're like, no. We're not leaving here, but this guy, you know, we'll get out. I mean, Bob's better, but he's not wanting to move right now. And this guy takes photographs of us. And he knew my brother in Dallas, Texas. Now, my brother, because he was living in Dallas. Now, Dallas is in that whole, you know, the super, you know, the show Dallas. That's what was happening in Dallas, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this guy's part of that, you know, that whole lifestyle, whatever. Mm-hmm. So he knows my brother through business. And my brother's a big businessman. Mm-hmm. So, and nobody knew where we were, by the way. Our families had no idea where we were. Huh. They've been worried sick about us. They've been trying to figure out how they're going to contact us. Mm-hmm. No contact. Wow. So he walks into my brother's office and he said, George, I want to show you something. Throws down these photographs of us. I mean...
Yeah, that's
a digression. Anyway, that's kind of, yeah. You know, so we left finally and went back, and then our visa was up.
You were tempted to stay for the 1968 Olympics in Mexico City?
No, we had to leave because of our visa.
Okay.
Yeah, and we had no money. Okay. We were totally out of money.
Okay, all right.
No money, and we had to come back to the States. But I remember when we came back, the thing that struck me the most was the garbage. Because in third world countries, there is no garbage. Everything is
utilized.
Everything. You know, there is no waste, you know. And I was like, oh my gosh. Because when you live like that, you know, but anyway. Uh-huh. Anyway, so we came back, and then we went back to Chicago in 68 for August. We were back here actually in June, I think, okay. And we were here.
Mm-hmm. Wow! And so the convention of 68. So were you in Lincoln Park? Were you in Grant Park? You were part of protests?
We were part of protests. Mm-hmm. I just remember being everywhere. I mean, I don't actually remember it very specifically. Mm-hmm. That's why the description that our friend has of he and Bob. I think I might have been more working, or, you know, Bob was always more free to join a lot of those protests. So in the book, he describes going in, you know, I think, what was his name, the guy who wrote that essay? I think it's Berendt, the same name as our son, by the way. We named him for him. Berendt, I don't know what name he used for the book. He's since changed his name to Von Zaren, but I think in the book he might have been Berendt Brown. But he wrote, there's not that many essays. Mm-hmm. You'll be able to find it. But you ought to interview him, mm-hmm, if you're interested in that. Because he's...
Oh, yeah, okay. But yeah, it's cool. But yeah. Well, you were there. Do you remember any of the protest leaders like Allen Ginsberg or...
Not really. So no, that it's all kind of a blur, okay. You know, because I was terrified. Uh-huh. I was personally terrified.
Yeah.
I was always terrified, you know, of the, I mean, it was, this is our country, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
This is our country.
Mm-hmm. And yet there's these battles going on. And yeah, I know, real wake up for a lot of people who didn't know that.
And then I was
police brutality and things like that.
I was teaching school at Cabrini Green. Mm-hmm. I had children in my class. I had 42 kids in my class. Mm-hmm. One of my classes. You know, I mean, you deal with the poverty. Those kids didn't have anything to eat, and they're being told to sit at a desk, you know.
Yeah. Were you teaching in the West Side, you say?
I taught at Cabrini Green, and then I taught in 69, actually, 69, 70, right before I had my first baby, I taught at a high school downtown where all the women, all the girls were pregnant. And when I was pregnant, you know, they said, oh, Miss Mater, don't worry. You can have the baby right here. We know how to do this. I taught everywhere. Then I was a children's librarian. I got my library degree, and I had a library on the West Side, you know. Mm-hmm. I think I told you that, right?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. Did you see a lot of the devastation from the riots of that spring, after King was assassinated in April of 68, there were riots on the West Side.
Yeah.
Places were burned, and so you saw that.
Yeah.
And all the disruption that was from that.
It was just such a painful time.
Yeah.
It was such a painful time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, because for me, I saw it through the eyes of the children.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's mainly how I saw it.
Yeah.
You know, the kids are just, they're still so lost, right?
Mm-hmm.
They're still lost.
So it sounds like, to kind of jump back to something you said earlier, that Bob was considered, you know, too old for the program at ID. But thinking about what he had experienced and photographed in, you know, just the 5 years prior.
Right.
I mean, I have to imagine that that was kind of unique amongst a lot of the people he was in school with.
Oh, yeah. They were all young. They younger than him. Yeah, he was the old man. Yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, sometimes professors can also be intimidated by life experiences. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know that for a fact because, you know, I was busy trying to supply the money for our family, and so I was working a lot, and so I didn't hang around with the ID group. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I didn't go with him. You know, I didn't even go to the parties. I wouldn't. You know, I was busy with my own life. Even though we were married, that's the kind of marriage we had. That's probably why it lasted so long.
Just quick question. How much of a feminist did you see yourself at that point? Or too busy to think about it?
No. I always felt very powerful as a woman. I had a unique relationship with my father, and I always credit him with imbuing me with that. So did I support the feminist movement? Not really by any actions. Okay. I mean, I think I lived the life of a feminist, but I don't think I didn't join their movements. Is that you're asking? Yeah. No, I did not. No. Okay. And then I chose to be a mother, and to be a mother of four children, and to have my children at home. I had births at home. Bob and I were on national TV because we had births at home, you know. I mean, if there was a feminist movement, mine was to take back my own self and not let the medical community have it.
Yeah,
that was how I think I was a very strong feminist in that sense.
Yeah, sure, absolutely.
Because I went to a doctor when I was pregnant, and he just basically told me that it was going to be his delivery, his child. This is what's going to happen, and I was like, what? That doesn't sound like anything I want to part of. But I didn't know what I was talking about, so I started reading and studying, and it's like, no, this is my baby. This is my birth. This is, and Bob was terrified of that at first, but then that was another thing that he said was so powerful in his life was home births, because he said it was the most holy experience he had ever had in his life, you know, being present at birth. And so that's another big part of who we were.
Sure.
Was children and that whole, we were hippies.
Yeah, you clearly were. You clearly were. But you got there on your own. You weren't mimicking anybody else. It does seem to really kind of flow out of who you were and your personalities. And I mean, obviously you live in a certain time, but no, right.
I appreciate
that's
you
fair
saying
to say
that. No one's ever said that. Thank you.
Okay. Well, anyway, back to the route toward ID.
Yeah. So I'm interested in hearing, and I know you can only kind of communicate this secondhand, but I assume Bob talked to you about it. You know, he was someone who wasn't coming into this program as a blank slate. You know, he had not just life experience, but photography experience. I mean,
good question.
Having climbed to the top of a pyramid to take a photo of another is probably not something that a lot of his classmates had done. And so I'm interested in, he viewed it as such a formative experience. I'm interested in, for someone who was already seemingly a bit of a detail-oriented, you know, technician with the camera. What were the things that he valued the most?
I think that's an excellent question. I think for him, he never had enough of anything that he wanted to know about. And I think he realized that he had no history of art, history of photography, understanding of form and design. He didn't have, what would you call that? The basic infrastructure of understanding the medium. And he didn't want to just be fly. I mean, he wanted to be educated, really, about photography. I mean, he wanted to really understand, you know, the greats that he studied and looked at. And he thought by being in a community of people who were really exploring that. And then I think getting to know who Mahaly Naj was, I mean, was a huge thing to him, because experimentation, I mean, Bob was a very restless person. I mean, hence the holography, hence the, you know, climbing the pier. I mean, you know, he was always, he had, it's interesting, I just had dinner last night with a very close friend of his who went to the Art Institute with him and had taught the history of art for years and years. He said, if I had one word for Bob, I would say it's heroic. And I said, well, what do you mean heroic? He said, he just always wanted to embrace everything.
Yeah,
he wanted to
Odysseus, you know.
He that, just yeah. I said that's such an interesting word. I've never heard anyone describe.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah.
Is that a
wanting to grab the world and travel the
world? Yeah, I mean,
and sort of the world and.
Yeah, he just really didn't want to be uneducated. And I think he saw the Institute of Design as, he looked at Rhode Island Institute of Technology, and what was the one other one that was available at the time? There was one in California, I think. Anyway, I mean, to him, it was just like, there was no question that the Institute of Design was at the top. And
did he feel that he got that here? Because, you know, Adam and I have interviewed others who've gone through the program, and apparently up to the mid-50s, if you were an undergraduate there, the first year or two was all about classical art and analysis. And that apparently faded somewhat. And so I don't know what the graduate students would be getting in terms of that. But was Bob satisfied with that anchoring?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I wish he could answer that. I really, from my perspective, hearing him talk to all the people that worked for him over the years, the question was always the same. Have you studied the history of art? Have you studied it, the history of photography? Do you understand from whence they came? And more and more as time went by, fewer and fewer people even knew what he was talking about. You know, do you know, Harry Callahan? Do you know who these greats? Have you studied their work? You know, do you... And it's almost like an engineer who doesn't know mathematics or something, or I don't know how you would describe that. So I feel like for him, that was a really wonderful part of it. And I think it gave him, so when he started accepting commissions for portraiture, you know, he always had in the back of his mind, you know, he always would tell me, he said, turn the photograph upside down if you want to see if it's worth anything. Look at the form, you know, not the content. It was always about the form, you know, and, you know, you've got to have the design lines. And, you know, and when he worked with people, I mean, he was always looking for perfection, you know, I would say. So I would say yes, and Dennis asked me that too. I said his entire life. He honored the Institute of Design. It was a very... And so when this conversation started about the possibility of us having a relationship with the Institute of Design, I mean, my kids and I are like, oh, my God. First of all, their father would say, there's no way, because there's been so many great people. You know, how would he be even considered? That would be number one. And number two, he would be very pleased. If he could be even associated with this.
Wow, that's quite a testimony, Well, he's a rich soul. I'm just sort of assuming his own reading and his own ability to pick these things. He probably self-educated on a lot of it as well.
Oh, he read. He was an obsessive.
But he's generous-spirited enough to have given credit to IED. I think that's true. I mean,
he also knew how to.
Other people went through the program who were not as generous in there.
Well, he asked questions. You know, he would stay with people. He would study with people.
Yeah,
he would.
Right.
He wanted to know everything. He would want to know everything you knew.
Uh-huh,
you know,
and
he was very humble.
Yeah.
He was very humble, really. I mean, he wasn't. You know, he would take the air out of the room, but he was humble. And it was hard to explain.
No, simultaneously. Yeah. Well, they're right. There's something about a willingness to learn and to explore and to be receptive and not be caught in his own persona that way.
Yeah.
So I'm interested in, you know, looking at the timeline. I'm interested in the period. So he goes to the Institute of Design and learns a lot, and it seems like he starts to work with different themes and kind of in different ways. You know, to see someone who has spent time taking photographs in Jordan and in this remote town in Mexico, then kind of move into like the bars and taverns of Chicago.
Well, he had an aunt who had a bar.
Ah.
His family is a very interesting family. His mother was Russian, and her oldest sister was a tough, tough woman who had a bar on the south side of Chicago where Bobby, do you know that shot in the book where he's on the floor and you see a leg?
Uh-huh, yeah.
You know that
uh-huh.
shot? Mm-hmm. That was done in her bar.
Okay.
Uh-huh. Okay. Uh-huh. And he hung out with Hell's Angels. And he, I mean, he just went into the belly of Chicago. He spent a lot of time down on, what's the area where, is it called Skid Row? No. What's it called here in Chicago?
Yeah, I forget. Like,
but you know what
downtown,
I'm talking about.
But Monroe,
the Bowery
Madison.
Was, yeah. No, that's New York.
New York. Okay, but it was near West Side, right? But downtown, kind of right against the Loop. There used to be kind
well,
of...
Well, he spent a lot of time that, in that, in those kinds of neighborhoods. Uh-huh. Then, I don't know if you... He did a book on autopsies. Oh, I forgot to send you the book.
Uh-huh.
Did you know he did a book on autopsies?
No, I saw the photos in the.
I'm going to send you the
in
book.
The monograph.
The book was the textbook for the medical schools that. What do you call the guys that are become autopsy coroners?
Coroners.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, he worked. He had a friend that was a doctor. Bob was always obsessed with death too. Mm. So when he was a little boy. He had a friend whose father was a funeral director. Mm. And they spent a lot of time in there. Not a lot of time, but he was exposed to that. So he's always fascinated with... He decided... where was it? When did he do that? It was in the 70s, right? He decided that he was going to do a book on emergency rooms. And there's a couple shots in the book about that. Mm. And one of our neighbors was a doctor who worked in the emergency room, so Bob got access that way. And then this doctor decided to do a textbook on autopsies. He said, Bob, will you do the photographs?
Hmm.
And without hesitation, Bob was like, yes. You know, so, I mean, do you see what I'm saying? I mean, the guy was...
Just taking it all in.
He was all over the place. Yeah. He was...
And it seems like he was really open to... Willing to kind of take what opportunities bounced his way and kind of run with them.
And then there's the Hull House. Remember Hull House?
Oh, yeah.
Bob and I, we had three kids. I was nursing my third baby, and we decided that we were going to... Bob was always in love with children. He always wanted to share with kids. And pinhole cameras, he thought, were just the greatest things in sliced bread to teach a kid about photography, pinhole cameras. So he was always teaching kids in the neighborhood. So then we got hooked up with Hull House, and we opened the Children's Center there. Wow. I don't know. There's
it says 1976.
Yeah, we opened the Children's Center, and I ran a program for dance and theater, and then he did photography. And we just had a wonderful time with that. I don't know how we made any money.
Uh-huh.
I have no idea. We didn't have a car. We had a one-bedroom place on Pratt. I mean, we never had money. Money was never our driving force until my brother convinced us to go that we had to think about money. And we went down to Dallas, and that's when we started, actually.
A couple years later.
Yeah.
But Hull House had, of course, been for many decades on the Near West Side, but then gets torn down for... UIC in the mid-60s. I don't know how much was left there, but basically it moved to the north side, right?
Yeah, we were on the north side.
And
so
you...
I was thinking I should go back there and see that.
Uh-huh.
It's still there?
They closed two, 3 years ago, right? It finally went. They finally closed.
It was incredible. I mean, Bob was so excited. He was teaching people who knew nothing about photography how to develop, and he just loved teaching. He loved teaching. He was a great teacher. I always wish that I had been able to take one of his courses, because when we moved to Texas, he's taught at the University of Dallas. No, University of University of Texas, Texas at Dallas.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
He taught photography. It was a brand new program. Mm-hmm. Now that place is just, now they're another place that was kind of interested in the archives. But anyway, he just, I met people through the years that had him as a teacher, and they said, oh my God, he was so amazing, because he was in love with it.
Sure. Any other interesting people that you remember from the Hull House days who are also teaching but different sorts of things, or are you just so busy with your particular program?
I had three kids.
And plus, right, yeah, making sure that they're taken care of.
And I was trying to make enough money somehow. I don't know how I did that. I had no idea.
Okay, wow.
I'm sorry, I wasn't more. Now, if Bob were here, he would
have no apologies to me.
He would probably reel off, because he never forgot any person's name. Never forgot a detail. And I'm the opposite. So I'm sorry, you got the wrong person in life.
No.
And so the move to Dallas, when it happens, is kind of a nod to your brothers urging you to start to think about
money
and getting things in order.
And it was the most painful decision. It was totally agonizing on so many levels. Now, Bob had gone down to the University of Texas, the Humanities Research Center, which you know of, right? And he was blown away by their collection. He saw the first photograph there.
Oh.
You know, the first photograph.
The 1826 D.P.
Yeah, they have it.
Oh, they actually own
it. You guys, if you ever get it, there's a cheap flight from Chicago Midway to Austin. If you ever get a chance, you too would love seeing Humanities Research. Anyway, he was blown away. At the time, it wasn't so well funded. Now it's so funded, it's ridiculous. But he went down, for some reason, he found this photographer, E.O. Goldbeck, who did circuit camera photography. Again, Bob's interest in the new whatever. So the guy was dying. He was in his 90s. And Bob was like, I want to go and spend some time with him. And he went and spent a month with him. I have recordings from, I'm trying to get the Humanities Research Center to take them and to develop them, that Bob did with him. He did recordings like you're doing. With E.O. Goldbeck, and studied his work and just spent time with him. The guy was fascinating. I mean, he's the one who had the mathematical genius to know how to set up on a tripod the mathematical formation. Have you ever seen the Insignia series? Oh, dear. I need to show you that. Okay. So he did these, what do you call large groups of soldiers? Battalions?
Neither of us are military people.
Okay, so say there's 500 military, and you want to get this, and he makes an insignia of this group. He decides he's commissioned by the Army to do this, or in the Navy, or whatever. So he gets them, and he's figured out that this row has to stand 6 inches from the next row, and the next row has to stand foot, and he has these mathematical calculations. So when you look at it, it's a beautiful formation. It looks like everyone's just put there. So this guy was a genius mathematically, and he did this all around the world. He did, you know, you know how kids now they take their high school thing and they run from one side to another.
Yeah.
Well, he's the one that developed those cameras, the circuit camera, so Bob studied with him and just found it. And so he had been spending some time in Texas, plus we had family there, and so we would go once a year to Dallas, and so, you know, it was like, and Bob's parents were leaving Chicago, we had no family here, we had 4 kids, so it seemed, but Bob, I knew it was not going to be about his art, it was going to be about money. And it was very painful for me. And I told him, I said, Bob, I'm a salesperson. I can sell anything. Let me sell, let me support the family, and you be an artist. He couldn't do it.
Okay.
He couldn't do it. He couldn't do that. So, okay. And you know, you always think, oh, I'll continue my art, and I don't know anyone that's been able to do that personally. Okay. Do you?
I don't.
Some, but with institutional support of that.
Yes.
That continuing.
That's true. You could teach and be an artist. Yeah. But he couldn't make enough money teaching.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know. Mm-hmm. So it was a very, and there's a very poignant photograph. I don't know if it's in the book or not, with a rug rolled up in a empty space. That was one of the last photographs he took of our apartment in Chicago.
But with the greater security and means, was he able? I'm sure that both of you continued to travel. And how did you try to balance, you know, your own sense of, you know, integrity and artistic need with this career? How was that managed?
Yeah. Ourselves?
Yeah.
And this career managed simultaneously. I don't think it was very well managed.
Okay.
I think it was a struggle and a really, and then we had some weird thing happen. This is another story. Mm-hmm. So Bob never ever lost track of any friend of his. He would visit his second grade girlfriend until not often, but I mean, he knew everybody that he had ever related to. And he had met a woman who became a producer for Phil Donahue.
Okay.
And Phil Donahue was filming in Dallas. And so she, you know, Bob got together and he showed her our studio and she noted it. And I think it was mid 80s. Anyway, I don't know when the Holograms came after that. Yeah, I think the Holograms came after. But anyway, so I think it was 86, maybe.
Yeah, according to the books.
Oh, you've got it right there. Okay. Uh-huh. Yeah. So they're in Dallas filming, you know, because Dallas, you know, the show Dallas is so big, and, you know, so anyway, they rekindled the relationship and stuff, and they went back to New York, and Phil Donahue decided, now this is pre-digital, this is an interesting story. He decided he wanted to do makeovers live on the television, but he didn't know how he would show the audience right away the result of the makeover. I mean, can you believe this? Today it would be like a joke, right? So she called up Bob and she said, Phil's having a really hard time understanding how to do this. And she said, I know how to do that. I do it, you know, I don't know. He was experimenting with something. Anyway, he said he knew how to do it. And so he's explaining in great detail to her how she can get this photographer to do it. And she's listening, and she calls him back, and she said, Phil said, just you come up and bring some of your clients to talk about Bob. Because he was starting to do something that became the biggest rage, which was called, I can't think of the name of it. When women, it was like a franchise that spread all over the country. It was not glamour shots, but something like that, where women would come in and have a makeover. It became a franchise, but Bob started it, you know, with women coming in who were feeling, you know, not so good about themselves, and we would get a makeup person, and I would help them find something beautiful to wear, and Bob would photograph them. So I forget, there's a name for it, if you look up the history of, anyway.
Yeah.
And by the way, the guy who ended up doing the franchise came to our studio, learned what Bob was doing, and he's the one that did the franchise. He wanted Bob to do it, and Bob was like, no, I'm done with that. But anyway, so he flies us to New York City, Bob and I, our whole staff, and six of our clients, puts us up. The show was seen by 42 million people. It was their highest rated show to date when we did it.
Wow.
Now.
But nobody captured it on video, hey? Or you were saying? Or
I don't know. Maybe somebody hasn't, but
yeah.
But the you know what was interesting to me, the lesson you learn is that totally blindsided us, right? Mm-hmm. Right? Okay, so now everybody, you know, knows who we are. Mm-hmm. But if you have something like that happen to you and you don't have the knowledge that that's going to happen to you and you don't have the infrastructure in place to benefit from publicity.
Yeah.
It you know what it does? It makes you poor. Because when we got home, all we did was answer the phone. The phone's ringing off the hook. Everybody wants interviews. We couldn't even keep our business going because, I mean, it's the 15 minutes of fame thing, right? It's so fleeting.
Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh.
It's so fleeting, you know. Anyway, yeah. I don't know how I got off on that one.
No, that's a good point. No, well, this is, chronologically, it's all fine.
You know? Well,
you were asking me something I didn't answer.
Yeah, I don't remember.
Oh, how do we deal with this?
Yeah,
okay.
Right.
So that happened, and then the holograms happened, and then I saw Bob really deteriorating, drinking too much, just not doing well. And we were hiring other photographers to try to take the pressure off of him so he didn't have all the pressure on himself. And I went to business school, not full time. I just took this course in entrepreneurship. And I had a great teacher, Jerry White. And I hired him to consult with us because I felt like we were just spinning our wheels. We weren't really making any money. And Bob was exhausted. And he said, Judith, there's two kinds of businesses, basically. There's the guru business. And there's the widget business. And you're trying to be in the widget business, and you should be in the guru business. There's only one Bob. People want him. You need to make him more valuable. 80% of your money is coming from 20% of your clients. You need to focus on the 20%. I was like, oh. So it was very scary, but I just kept raising our prices.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And I thought, we're going to lose. And Bob said, you can't do that. We're going to lose. I said, you know, I could see he was going to just. And that's what worked.
Yeah.
And we just started. And then our kids were older. You know, now we travel a lot with them in the summers. We would go to Colorado and Aspen and you know, all the places where the wealthy were, and we'd photograph them there. And you know, we would travel some, but by that time, our kids are old enough that we can start accepting, you know, clients in New York and California and then Europe. And so we just kept going up and up and up until, and then Bob was given so much freedom by these clients to do whatever he wants. Like Jerry Jones was one of our clients, and he said, what's the most beautiful place in the world? Where do you want to go?
What backdrop do you want? That's right.
And wow. Bob said, well, I want to go to Carmel, you know, to what is that, the place, that, well, you know, where Ansel Adams did all the photography, you know, the coast of California, basically. And, I mean, it was that kind of freedom, but as I was telling Dennis, with that freedom and that money comes another kind of pressure. What if somebody said to you, you are going to create a masterpiece today with my family?
Yeah.
Oh, that's true, yeah.
And I'm going to hang it next to a Picasso.
That's true.
So,
Bob,
I mean...
How did Bob handle that?
He did okay. I mean it's certainly a different kind of pressure. He had bigger and bigger teams to help him. We would spend months preparing for a shoot, you know, and we had an incredible team. We had assistants, and I mean, we would go, for instance, for that shoot, we went a week before, we scouted for days. I mean, I would climb over, I would follow him, and, you know, he was trying to find the quintessential place to do a photograph of whether it was a family or an individual, or, I mean, he was looking, you know, and then with Michael and Susan Dell, who were big clients of ours for years, I mean, they wanted innovation. They sent out every year a Bob Mader card to 1,500 of the most important people in our country at the time, right? And what do you think they wanted on that card? They wanted something so extraordinary that people would just gasp when they got it. So then we brought interior, we brought graphic designers in, and you know, and we. I should get you some of those cards. You'd probably find that interesting.
Yeah.
Let me do that.
Well, something that strikes me, looking at the monograph, you know, you're flipping through the pages, and it's black and white, and it's, you know, men in bars, and then boom, you turn the page, and it's
commission work,
full color, and I thought, boy, what a transition. So it's interesting. Mm-hmm. It's interesting to hear you explain that, but
we had to make money. We made a decision that we would pay for our children's undergraduate. Well, you know what that cost.
Yeah.
I mean, it was like, I never thought we would make it through, really. Even though we were making good money, that's a lot of money.
Oh, I know.
And when our youngest son graduated from Brown, that was 2001. And I was going to drop our insurance policy because we had gotten the kids through college. Mm-hmm. And you know how expensive insurance policies are. Uh-huh. And our bookkeeper said, just hold on to it a little bit more. Mm-hmm. And Bob was diagnosed with cancer in September. Mm-hmm. So we never had time to build our own, you know. But but anyway, I mean, wonderful life. I mean, I'm not saying that, but... But yeah, so then I was telling Dennis this morning, it was interesting, there was kind of a weird thing that started happening where if you, like we photographed a man who lived in, it was part of the Silicon Valley, you know, he's on 60 Minutes for his work with, you know, seeing Google before Google and what do you call those guys? They invest ahead of
venture capitalists.
The biggest venture capitalist firm in the country was, and Ray Lane was